if you want to get repeat investors, you have to make sure that you set up your investor relations process to protect the downside for your investors. And a GP catch-up does not do that at all. There's no benefit at all whatsoever for the LPs in a GP catch-up. It is only for the operator, and it's not based on performance. It's based on, I want to get caught up because I want to be at the same level as you before we do any more equity splits.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm so excited to announce our special guest for the day, Dan Hanford. Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Awesome. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really looking forward to the show.
Excellent. So we're going to get into a whole bunch of topics, but first, a little bit about Dan. Dan and his wife, Danae, along with their four children and a standard poodle, reside and work in Columbia, South Carolina. Dan Hanford is one of the managing partners with PassiveInvesting.com, which is the national passive investing apartment firm based in the Carolinas. He has led his apartment syndication company to acquire 2,680 units with a portfolio valued over $357 million. He's also a passive investor himself in 8,800 units in 38 different syndication investments located across the USA. Well, that is quite a background, Dan. Really excited to hear from you. Obviously, you're super active in this space on the educational front. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into real estate and why you did?
Sure. Yeah. So my background is primarily actually in business. And so even today, I still own a group of non-surgical orthopedic medical clinics here in the Carolinas. And so we have a location here in Columbia, South Carolina. We have one in Charleston, Greenville, South Carolina, and then North Augusta, South Carolina. And those clinics, when I started them, my wife and I started them from scratch. It took us a while to get them to the point of being very profitable, but now they're, you know, definitely very profitable and cash flow very well. And what we were finding is that we were working all year long and having to write really large six-figure checks to the government. And we wanted to find a way to be able to reduce that taxable liability. And as we all know, investing in real estate allows us to have those tax benefits of being able to reduce that taxable income, especially if you're classified as a real estate professional. You can also now start to offset some of your other ordinary income as well. But even just from the passive perspective, having been able to offset passive income was very beneficial for us to be able to keep more of the money that we actually make. And now we actually make more money in real estate than we do in those clinics, which is actually pretty neat to see.
Wow, that's awesome. And yeah, for all of you business owners out there, you know, it's so important to figure out a tax strategy that's going to benefit you and also help build our country. You know, I mean, there's a reason why the tax code favors real estate is because we want to continue to invest in our built environment. So Dan, you know, that's a great reason to get into real estate. And you've obviously come so far since then. Why don't you tell us about your first kind of foray into apartment syndicate? Or did you do any single family or did you just go straight into apartments?
I went straight into apartments. So I did kind of do some initial research in the beginning about, hey, maybe I should dabble in some single family fix and flips or homes or whatever. But I really looked at that as a very slow process getting to where I wanted to go very fast. I'd already done something and grown the clinics to the point where they were eight-figure business, and being able to just start with a, you know, single family home just wasn't very exciting to me.
Totally.
And so that's why we went straight into the apartments first. And the first thing we did was straight into the apartments. What we did first though is we invested passively first as LPs, limited partners, and then we started to join other groups and kind of do co-GPs or partner with them to kind of build our track record, build our credibility, and of course, learn the ropes, if you will, reduce the learning curve. And then we started to do our own deals. And our very first deal that we did all on our own was a $8.9 million, 130 unit property that we actually just sold yesterday. So pretty cool that it's already gone full cycle.
Congratulations. That's a very exciting marker for you. So
thank you.
Yeah. Awesome work. And where was that, by the way?
It was out of Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay. Yes. Hot market.
Yep. Very, very good market. Yeah, we have a couple other assets now in that market already. So
yeah, makes sense. Awesome. So you got started passive investing, and how did you gain comfort, you know, with that first passive investor choosing a syndicator to invest with and a deal you liked?
Honestly, I was so eager to invest passively that when I was first investing passively, I really didn't do a very good job of vetting operators and making sure the deal was the right deal and looking at the underwriting. I just thought these guys must know what they're talking about. Here's my money, you know, go play with it, right?
Was it somebody you knew at all, or, you know, how did that introduction get made?
Yeah, it was through a mutual friend that I did know. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely recommended to me from somebody. But even today, I wouldn't invest with that operator, right? Because of some of the things that have gone on since then. And I don't necessarily think the deal itself is going to go bad or south, and I'll still make some money off of it. I'm not going to lose my money, which is what's nice about this space. But now I know a little bit more about, you know, making sure I look at the various items within the underwriting and what are some of the big, you know, red flags, if you will, that you need to really look for when kind of choosing which operator you're going to put your money in. And when you read the bio earlier, you know, you said 38 investments. My wife and I now have 52 different passive investments with about 15 different operators across the country and over 10,000 units. So we have quite a bit of LP money that's sitting out there, which is great. And it's also constantly working for us, which is nice, but we've definitely been able to kind of learn a thing or two about that.
Yeah, for sure. So let's actually talk about that investment, you know, and how that has helped you learn what red flags, you know, you would look for going forward. So that first investment that you got into without really knowing the sponsor, you know, a lot of people probably do that. And while, yeah, what were some of the things that, you know, you would prefer happen differently and would want differently in the future?
Sure. And all of the things that we've learned were not just on that one deal, right? You know, there's definitely some things we learned on that deal, but it's been, you know, and a lot of the things we've learned from just putting deals together on our own, right? But even from that very first, you know, deal, I would say that one of the red flags that we look for is if there is nobody on the operations team that has any background or success in business, right? And so, because when it comes to these large apartment complexes that we are investing in as a passive investor, we're really putting money into a business. We're actually putting money into this business that we are buying together with other investors. And the people who are the main operator need to know how to actually run the business, right? They need to know how to actually run a business in general, because they have to know how to manage people. They have to know how to put in different systems and procedures and processes, and also know how to set certain KPIs to make sure that they need to pivot, they can pivot. And it's not just that I'm looking for somebody that has some form of background in business, because I know you and I probably know people that have had backgrounds in business, but they've run businesses into the ground instead of being successful with them. Right? So I don't want them to have just run a business, because I want to make sure they've run a successful business. And that's one of the key things that we look for is making sure that there's somebody on the operations team knows how to run a business and run it very well and very efficiently and very clean.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a really great point. I mean, one of the things that's so great about real estate is that you can get into it with a lot of experience, but knowing how to be a successful business person is just, it's actually somewhat different, or it's just, it doesn't, you know, we're not going to be successful at real estate unless we understand how to be successful at business. And so that's a really great point. So, yeah. So, I mean, I would say, what are some of the other red flags that you have learned over the many years that you've been doing this?
Sure. So another one is about the number of managing partners that are on a team. So there's actually a friend of mine out of New York City that invested $200,000 of his own money, and he actually convinced his friend to put in $200,000 of his own money into a deal. And it was a single operator deal. And so there was only one managing partner, and that was it, right? There was no team. I mean, obviously they had the property managers that were on site and stuff like that, but it was one managing partner for the private equity group. And it was a fairly new group as well, right? And what happened was, is 6 months into the deal, the main operator fell off the face of the earth. They couldn't find him. And so they don't know if he like went on vacation somewhere and like, you know, slipped and fell on a rock and killed himself. Like they can't find him anywhere. So the property's still there. The cash flow is still there. The money is still there. Everything is still there, but they can't get access to it because they're not the main operator. And inside of the operating agreements, it states that if you can't come to an agreement on something, that you have to arbitrate, right? Go through arbitration first. And the problem is how do you arbitrate with somebody who you can't find? So now they're kind of stuck in this like legal limbo of trying to get their money and their cash because the operator is gone. And so one of the red flags for me is when an operator only has one managing partner. I really truly feel like this business must be run by at least two managing partners that are unrelated and as far as family related. We don't want just a husband and wife. I'd rather have a husband, or not a husband, a man or a woman, and then another man or a woman as managing partners, right? We'll have two people. And that way, if for some reason something happens to one, we still have another one that we can go to, right? If you have any questions or issues or anything like that. Ideally, three, which is what we have at PassiveInvesting.com, is we have three managing partners, right? And each one of the three managing partners has different areas that they're really good at and brings strengths to the table. And we can focus on those strengths as we continue to grow the group. So that would be probably number two, is making sure that there's more than one managing partner. So the red flag would be if there's only one managing partner, turn the other way and don't invest, right?
That's kind of
my biggest thing.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So like, I mean, if you go to the property, it's there, it's operating, but the operating partner just stopped communicating or is, you know, I mean, because someone has to be managing it, right?
Correct.
Okay. So they basically
if they go MIA, what do you do?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. For sure.
Chances of two people going MIA is going to be pretty rare.
Yeah.
Especially if they practice certain, liability issue, not a liability, but I don't know what they actually, I can't remember the name of it, but instead of basically flying on the same jet together, right, to go on vacation somewhere, they're going to fly on two separate airplanes, right?
Yeah.
Instead of being all on the same plane, and if the one plane goes down, everybody's gone.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
Contingencies. So, there we go.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to, you know, ask another question on that. So is it possible to like contact the law firm that drew up the operating agreement and the PPM?
They're having to go through and get a court order. So they have to go through a judge and hire an attorney and all that kind of stuff in order to get them to approve the transfer to the actual partners that actually own it, because the limited partners have no control over anything. So there's no way for them to get access to anything. And they have to basically go and get that court order to do that. So they're kind of in that little legal limbo battle right now, trying to get access to it, because the property management company won't even talk to them because they're not the main operator. So they're not on the checking accounts. They're not on the operating accounts. They're not on anything. They can't do anything. So it's,
oh my gosh,
it's frustrating.
Yeah, totally. What a mess. Yes. So important. Also just, you know, focusing on the who and not necessarily the who, not the how, is something that people are saying a lot these days. And it's so important in real estate, is who you're investing with is really the crux of the deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, great. So more than one operating partner, or it's a red flag. What else?
So another one would be a part-time operator. So, you know, this is a type of business that really demands full-time efforts. Mm-hmm. And so for us, if there's an operator and that they're treating it more like a side hobby of whether they're doing it in nights and weekends and they're trying to hold on a corporate job, you know, we won't invest, but they shouldn't be the main operator, right? They can go and be a part of another team and help out somewhere else, but they can't be the main operator on an actual deal, because we know from our own group that this takes full-time efforts. I mean, we have 15 people on our team right now that are managing our assets. And so we know that we can't just do this nights and weekends. This has got to be a full-time gig. And you can still hire people to help manage things, different pieces for you, but you want to make sure that we have full-time efforts on this and that it's not being treated as a side hobby, because I've worked hard for the money that I've made. And I know a lot of our investors and all of them have worked very hard for their money as well. And we want to make sure that we have full-time efforts that I'm overseeing and managing their investment.
Yeah, for sure. I think that definitely makes sense from the passive investor perspective. What advice would you give to active investors who are trying to get started in syndication but haven't left their W-2 jobs yet?
Sure. Go partner with somebody. We did in the very beginning too, is we partnered with somebody else, co-GP'd with them. And that's also where you might even find your eventual future managing partners, is by going and co-GPing with somebody else and learning the ropes from somebody else.
Yeah.
That's what I would suggest first, is go find somebody else who is full-time and go help them, whether it be from underwriting or due diligence or asset management or raising capital, you know, whatever that area of expertise that you have, that's what you should go help them with. And that's what you should do first before you try to jump out of your W-2 or just jump out of your W-2 and do this full-time, right? If you really don't want to just burn the bridges, that is another option, you know?
Totally, for sure. Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it's also just, it lends itself towards doing it the right way, right? Because if you're partnering with someone who does have their full attention and full focus on it, someone who you vibe with, someone who you have developed a personal relationship with and like their investment thesis and philosophy, then, you know, you can learn a lot from them through the experience of working with them that you wouldn't necessarily be able to learn on your own. So, exactly. Or with other part-time folks. Okay, great. So is there another red flag you'd like to share?
Sure. Another one would be when an operator models a refinance into their underwriting and into their projections.
Yeah.
for me, it's a big no-no, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to see that. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't like refinances. I mean, I love refinances. I love getting capital back. All that kind of stuff is great. But what I don't want to do is I don't want to underwrite that in the very beginning. And the deal is contingent upon whether or not I actually have a successful refinance. I want the refinance to be a cherry on top or the icing on the cake, right?
Yeah.
It can't be what actually makes the deal go forward.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think that's such a critical one. And it's often, I mean, you know, you'll see people sneak that in there and all of a sudden the deal looks like really sweet or it just works. And it's really important to, I would agree, just be, you know, draw a hard line with that. Like just not, I mean, it's, I think it's okay personally that if there is like a set plan from a bank, like if they have, you know, a plan from a bank that is not going to change, which I've seen happen, to at least mention that as kind of like an extra bonus that may occur, but not to have it in the core projections.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah, no, I have no problem talking about that's what you want to do and what could potentially happen if we do it. But most of the time when you see an operator using a refinance in their underwriting, it usually means that they're trying to do something else, which I would say is another red flag, which is trying to do a preferred return, but do a GP catch-up with the preferred return. And, you know, to kind of break that down just a little bit, for those of you who might be listening, not understand what that really is, you know, the preferred return is really to protect the investors. And that's a big red flag for me if there's not a preferred return, especially if there's a preferred return, but there's a GP catch up with it. And so what basically is a preferred return is 100% of the cash flows on a property. It's going to go to you as the investor up to that preferred return amount. So usually between about 7 to 9%, somewhere around in there. And then after that preferred return is usually when the equity splits occur. So it may be 70-30 split, 70% to the investors, 30% to the operator. And that's a typical waterfall that you will usually see with one hurdle in it. And with a GP catch-up, the investors get 100% of the cash flow up to the preferred return. And then before the equity split kicks in, what happens is that the operator gets caught up to that 7% as if they would have already gotten their 70-30 split up to that point. So instead of having a true just split above the preferred return, they're going back and saying, I want to get caught up to where I should have been if I would have been getting it all along. And the problem with that is that it usually is very expensive for the deal to be able to do that and make it make sense. And so one of the only ways that can make sense for them to do it is for them to model in a refinance. And so those are some really major red flags where even if some of these other ones, you're like, oh, I can deal without that. I can deal without that. This kind of stuff you can't deal without, because when it comes to these GP catch-ups and the refinances, they're going to make the deals not pencil the way they're actually originally projected. So those are really, really big red flags.
For sure. And, you know, I have personally not been part of a deal that has a GP catch-up, but is there a situation like, say there's no refinance, would you find a potential? I mean, obviously there's a lot of factors here, but is there any situation in which you think a GP catch up? I mean, obviously the refi was the red flag, but what about the GP catch up?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is that it's especially right now in the current market, it's very hard for a GP catch up to even make sense at all.
Yeah.
It's very hard to underwrite without a GP catch up, let alone trying to add in a GP catch up. Because what you're basically saying is let's just do a quick math here, right? So let's say we have $10 million worth of equity into a deal, right? And of that $10 million, we're going to give out 7% preferred return to investors. So that's $700,000. Well, if I were paying the GP along the way, right? That means the GP would be getting $300,000 at the same time, 70-30, right? So the 3% would go to the operators. That's $300,000. Let's say you were in that deal for 3 years before you now decided to do a refinance. Well, that's $900,000 that you have to catch up the GP with before the investors get anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big number to overcome, especially in the current environment right now where cap rates are compressing, the returns are compressing and coming down. And so it's very hard to do. But is it possible? Sure, it is. It is still possible to do. And I wouldn't be opposed to it depending on the deal dynamics, but there's different ways to allow the operator to get more money based on performance versus instead of doing a GP catch-up, mm-hmm. right? You could actually, instead of saying, you know, I'm going to do a GP catch-up first before I do any equity splits, you could go in there and say, okay, I'm going to do a secondary or a tertiary hurdle in the waterfall where, you know, it's 70-30 split after the 7% pref. That's the first hurdle in the waterfall. The second hurdle in the waterfall might be a 12 or 13%, you know, internal rate of return, IRR. Then it splits 50-50. And if I really outperform this property and it goes above 20% return for the investors, I'll split it 50-50. I mean, I'll split it 70-30 the other way, where mm-hmm. or 30-70. So 30% of the investors,
right.
70% for the operators. So there's other ways that you can still protect your investors and also protect you and give yourself some more upside, but it's all based on performance.
Yep.
And that's really when you're putting together an investor relations process, that's really what you have to look at is the investors are how you actually make the deals work, because you have to have their money in order to make the deal make sense. And so if you want to get repeat investors, you have to make sure that you set up your investor relations process to protect the downside for your investors. And a GP catch-up does not do that at all. There's no benefit at all whatsoever for the LPs in a GP catch-up. It is only for the operator, and it's not based on performance. It's based on, I want to get caught up because I want to be at the same level as you before we do any more equity splits.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate you breaking that down for our listeners about the refi and the GP catch-up. Okay, any other red flags?
I got two more. So I got two Perfect. More left. So one of them would be having distributions as return of capital versus return on capital. This is a big kind of discussion that I've seen in a couple of deals where I won't invest with it if it's return of capital. And this is hard sometimes because investors gloss over some of these words, but it's a two-letter word that changes the dynamics of your returns of the word. And it's only one letter, on or of, right? And what I want to see is that distributions are a return on my capital, not a return of my capital. And to really understand why, you have to understand how the preferred return is calculated. So the preferred return in any deal is calculated based off of the unreturned capital contributions. And that would be your initial contribution of capital minus any large capital events or returns of your capital. And so if I'm constantly giving distributions out as return of capital, that unreturned capital contribution account is going down every single time I get a distribution. And what that's doing is my preferred return is going down and down and down as well. So I'm getting to the point of diluting my preferred return. Whereas a return on your capital is giving you the return on your capital, but you're maintaining that unreturned capital position so that your preferred return stays the same and stays where it should be throughout the hold period. And that's a big, 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 big thing there to make sure that you, again, are as an operator, if you set it up that way, you're protecting your investors, right? You
want
to make sure that your investors are getting the money that they should be getting versus you as the operator. Because that's the thing. From the operator perspective, it's great. You do return of capital because the more and more you can get rid of the preferred return, the more money you're going to get on the equity splits down the road, right?
Yeah, but it's so important to have that alignment of interest and to really do right by your investors, right?
One of the arguments that the operators will say that do this will say, Well, it helps you from a tax perspective, because if I'm giving you your initial capital back with distributions, then you're not going to have to pay any taxes on that. And my argument to that is, well, if you're doing a cost segregation study property on the asset, you're going to have depreciation that's going to offset that income anyway, and you're not going to pay any taxes on it right now anyway.
Yeah.
So you're just kicking the ball down the road, and whether you get, whether you're going to do it via depreciation or you're doing it versus during the return of your capital, you're still reducing your basis in the property. So when you sell the property, you're going to have a recapture of that.
Yeah. Right? So one thing,
so there's still going to be taxes.
Yeah. So just one thing on that. One thing I've seen operators do is the distributions are made on a return on capital basis. And so that continues for the life of the deal. Like, it's a return on capital, but from a tax perspective, they'll report it as a return of capital. So there's like additional losses that the operator can take, or the LP can take on, you know, other rental income or whatever passive income that they have. So have you seen that?
I have seen that, but I still don't see why it makes any sense.
Yeah.
Because to me, it doesn't make any sense to do it that way, because it's technically not what you're doing. So you're basically misreporting the income so that you can classify it one way, but, you know, not reduce the unrecovered capital contribution, which again, still doesn't make sense to me from a tax perspective.
Yeah, for sure. Makes sense. Okay, great. Thanks for breaking that down. It's a really important point that people should definitely look out for. And it's just one, it's basically one letter, you know, an F or an N. Yep. So it's an important one to look for in your documents. Okay. Last red flag.
Last red flag is skin in the game. Or I guess the red flag would be no skin in the game, right?
Right.
We want to make sure that the operator themselves has some skin in the game, right? Our group at passiveinvesting.com, one of the things that we do is we invest between 5 to 10% of the equity inside of each one of our projects alongside of our investors. And that can many times, especially with the deals that we're putting together right now, be some pretty significant capital into the seven figures, right? We're actually closing a deal right now next week that is a $91.6 million deal, right? And we're raising $30 million for that project. So you do 5 to 10% of that, that's, you know, $1.5 to $3 million. And actually it's right around $2.5 million that we're putting into that deal alongside of our investors. And so it's a lot of money, but I know our investors like to see that there's this alignment of interest, not only in how the structure is done on the deal, but also that they're putting their own money together with the investors. And we're going to be able to, you know, have that skin in the game, if you will. Now, some people, when they're first getting started, they're like, well, I don't have that kind of money to put in. And, you know, we didn't want to put that kind of money in the very beginning either, right? But one of the things I like to see at a minimum is at least $100,000 co-investment alongside me and the investors. Mm-hmm. And some people will argue and say, well, what if they're just rolling in their acquisition fee? That's fine. I don't really care, right? Because that's still their money, still their skin that they have in the game. So if they're earning it off of an asset management acquisition fee or whatever, they can, I don't mind if they roll that in, but I want to see them rolling something in or having some form of at least $100,000 or more from the operator investing alongside me as an investor.
Yeah, for sure. Makes a lot of sense. It's so important. And it's something that automatically, you know, at least helps people understand that you believe in the deal yourself, you know, and that you're willing to put your own money on the line for this thing that you're selling, you know? So great red flag. Okay. Awesome. Well, so Dan, you know, I would like to hear your take. I mean, I'd love to hear your take on, you know, what it is that you're doing in the space from an educational perspective, because obviously, you know, you are an important point of entry for many people into the syndication business. Yeah.
So we actually have a group called the Multifamily Investor Nation, and it's primarily designed to be able to educate people who are learning about investing for the first time inside of multifamily investing, whether it be from the active's perspective, active investor perspective, or as a passive investor. Because I even feel like from a passive investor's perspective, you should learn how to underwrite a deal. You should learn how to vet an operator. You should learn how to, you know, do a comp analysis, and you should learn how to do a lot of these different things that operators are doing so that you can intelligently review other operators' offering memorandums to see, are these legitimate, right? Are these numbers that they're presenting to me proper? And it'll also build your confidence. So we do weekly webinars every single week on various topics. Each one of the managing partners here at passiveinvesting.com jumps on a webinar every week, and we will present on a particular topic. I mean, we've been doing that pretty consistently for the last several years, really producing a lot of weekly content to our investors, not just to our investors, but to the MFIN community. And we have a little over 35, 40,000 people now that are part of that MFIN group, the Multifamily Investor Nation. We also have a podcast that we put together where we only interview specific investors that are active investors that have actually closed a multifamily deal in the last 12 months. We're getting active investors to talk to us about what's actually happening right now in the market on their particular projects. And that's been very, very crucial and very, very vital for a lot of people to learn what other people are doing, right? And there's no fluff on there. We don't talk a lot. We don't interview a lot of just experts. We actually only interview active investors. So most of the people on there aren't even experts, because honestly, a lot of the experts aren't actually closing deals. They're just educating, right?
Is that what you would classify as an expert? Someone who's like teaching on the subject?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's like a guru or something like that.
Yeah, they're got just it.
Out there in front of everybody. You'd be surprised at how many of them actually don't actually close deals, but
yeah,
we won't get into that too much. I think part of it's because they get distracted with the coaching side, right? The coaching and the mentoring, and you know, they might've done it in the past, but don't have the current knowledge. So again, that podcast is good because, you know, we get a lot of them that ask to be on, but we're like, have you closed a deal in the last 12 months? And of course we hear crickets from them because they haven't, but we only interview active real world people that are closing deals. And that podcast is basically just called the Multifamily Investor Nation podcast. So you can find it on all these different platforms. And then of course, twice a year, we have our Multifamily Investor Nation Summit, which is where we bring all the people in multifamily together. We usually have about 40, 50 speakers, and we'll have over 500 to 1,000 attendees at each one of those. It's a virtual all online event. We didn't just start doing it because of COVID like everyone else. We've been doing it since the very beginning. I mean, you know that as well.
Yep.
And that's been something that we've been doing from the very beginning that has definitely helped us. And then the last thing that we do is we produce a meetup group every month. So we have 53 meetup groups with co-organizers across the country with 53 different areas or cities across the country. And these co-organizers, as a matter of fact, the hour before I got on with you, I was educating them on the topic coming up for the Monday meetup that's coming up on July 5th. So the first Monday of every month, we get together around 6 p.m. in the local time zone to be able to network with other investors, but also to learn some content and then just be around other people and to create that meetup. And so some of the main things that we're doing from a content perspective when it comes to multifamily right now. And of course, I could talk about self-storage as well. We have our self-storage front that we just launched earlier this year, and we have a self-storage fund that we actually just launched last week. So there's a lot of things that we're doing from an educational perspective, from syndication on the multifamily side, but also on the self-storage front.
Totally. Yeah. Such an important asset class. So recession resistant. And yeah, it's one of my personal favorite asset classes. Yeah. So just to vouch for, you know, all of Dan's content, it's amazing. The summit that he does twice a year is amazing. And it's a wonderful, I mean, yeah, before COVID, I went to it and it was such a wonderful opportunity because I was able to go to an event and talk to, you know, or see so many people present, and I didn't have to make a large investment at all. I mean, it's like $100 or something. And so it's a wonderful way to learn so much and also get contacts and meet people and start the networking if you don't live in a city where there's a lot of multifamily activity, and I don't. And so it's a really wonderful resource. Thank you so much, Dan, for coming on the show and sharing such great, you know, information and resources. I do want to ask you one question before we wrap up. And that is, what would you say drives you to continue on in this business? What's your big why, your purpose, your mission?
Sure. I would say that there's really kind of two main drivers. One is my family. So like you said earlier on in the kind of intro, I'm married. I have 4 children. They're actually fairly young. I have a 10-year-old, 9-year-old, 3-year-old. So my wife and my 4 kids definitely keep me motivated. And then the other thing is I actually started a foundation a few years ago called the Fortify Foundation, which helps support and come alongside nonprofit Christian private education and the private high school and even some colleges, but some of the smaller to mid-sized schools that don't necessarily have the ability to have their own foundation or endowment or scholarships, and we come alongside them and actually teach them how to put that into their schools and using some of our investing ideas and strategies to be able to put their money to work, to be able to allow their money to be able to grow. And we can now, instead, because a lot of these small organizations will never have $5 million in assets to be able to invest like an accredited investor and get institutional level investments. But if we can pool the resources of multiple, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of these schools together, we can aggregate the resources, increase the returns for everybody overall.
That's so awesome. And, you know, what a great, wonderful cause to put your expertise and acumen in this space towards. So just providing a ton of value back to the community in so many ways, Dan.
Thank you
so much for coming on the show. Would you please, I mean, obviously you spoke to your content. What's an easy way for people to get a hold of you?
Sure. I would say there's two easy ways. So obviously, if you want to reach out to us on our website, you can go to passiveinvesting.com. If you want to join our Passive Investor Club, you can click on that little blue button on the top right-hand corner, fill out the form, and then one of our investor relations team members will reach out to you.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dan, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.